days ago, I had the great pleasure of being in an online session with Mike Wesch. It was organized by Nelly Deutsch, and Nelly and Mike were having a conversation about a number of things. And as is always the case with Mike Wesch, every time I hear him, as Nelly said, I learn something new and I learn something great and hear something interesting. The conversation started looking at the question of media and what effect it's having on us. Mike said media is our environment. It's nothing separate from our existences now. Our entire milieu is drenched by media. Let's have a listen to what Mike said about how media is changing us.
Well, his idea is that media really is our environment, that it so encompasses our lives that it's just all around us all the time. That's actually why I'm so interested in using media in my classes, is not because my students like that I use media in my classes. I use it and I ask them to use it in ways that make them more aware of how media might be using them. There's a really great pioneer in this. He wrote this book called The Un-TV and the 10-mile-per-hour Car. He's a sociologist, and I'm blanking on his name, so I'm just going to look it up real quick. But it's a great book. It's almost 20 years old now. But you guys can all see it there. I can bring it up if anybody else, or somebody else wants to link it. I'll try to post it here. So there's the link. It's by Bernard McGrane. And what he has in there are a bunch of experiments. You can see the name of the subtitle is called Experiments in Personal Freedom in Everyday Life. And what it is it's about understanding how technologies around you, like televisions and cars, he's doing this in the early 90s, how these things affect your life in ways that you might not be aware of. And so he asked you, for example, to do a series of experiments with your television. So you turn the sound off, and then he asks you just to count the technical events. Like if there's a zoom in, that's one. If they zoom out, that's two. If there's scrolling text across the screen, that's three. If there's a pan, that's four. And you just watch the point of this is to look at television, not for what it's saying, but for what it's doing and how it forces you to see the world. And there's a lot of really great insights in that book beyond just television. The effects of the car, for example, and how it changed the way we build our cities, and those types of things. It's all revealed through these really interesting experiments.
The conversation then turned to the brain. So when we as a species engage with technology to an intense and so frequent a degree, does anything happen to our brain? And I was pleased that he referred to the work of Nicholas Carr. He actually thought the best overview of neuroscience and learning around at the moment was, in fact, Nicholas Carr's book, because I've spent a lot of time thinking about Carr's work over the last year or two. So I think it's finally getting the respect that I think it always deserved but didn't get initially. So let's hear what Mike says about how this being saturated in media and internet technology in particular might be affecting our brain.
Well, there's a lot of research going on in that. I would say the best overview of the research available right now is The Shallows by Nicholas Carr. I just linked it in the chat there. That's the best overview. He's citing a lot of other work, but it's relatively recent, it's within the past year, and it really does bring you up to date on how it's affecting our brains. I think that the internet is affecting us in more substantial ways socially than through our brains. And the reason why I say that is because a lot of the reasons that we do the things we do with our technology are socially driven or culturally driven. And you can really see this very quickly if you travel much and get into cultures that are radically different than ours. If you look at how people in other cultures use different technologies, they sometimes use them very differently. So they're not going to affect the way they think in the same way they affect the way we think with the way we're using the technologies. The other aspect of this is that it's actually, once a technology is embedded in a cultural system, that use of the technology is much more difficult to change than if it's just in your neurological system. Our cultural systems are actually much more robust and slower to change than our neurology. So, for example, there are studies that show that while there are fairly significant differences between somebody who, like in the wiring of the brain, there's significant differences between somebody who plays a lot of video games versus somebody who doesn't. Within 5 days, those differences can go away. So if you take a bunch of people who don't play video games and you set them down to play video games, 5 days later, they have a lot of the same neurological connections. The research that says this is that we should look at this, that it's changing the way we think, is legitimate because our brains are plastic. But that plasticity is so great that we can actually reverse those changes very quickly. Some things are more complex, like reading alters our brain pretty dramatically, and it really takes a long time to grasp reading. That's why, you know, children don't just immediately begin reading. So reading is one of those things that has really dramatically changed our brains. And you know, if you're ever in a non-literate culture, people who can read and people who can't read, and cultures who are based around reading versus cultures who are not based around reading, there's a lot of dramatic differences there.
And now to the thing that really struck me most about this presentation. When Mike was asked to talk about what he thinks makes a successful teacher, he simply said, love. You've got to love your students. And some years ago, well, not that long ago, I was listening to a television program here in Australia run by Judith Lucy. Judith Lucy is an Australian comedian, had been interviewing a number of people about notions of spirituality. And she actually went to the former captain of an Australian football club, a very macho male environment, and asked him, what do you think makes a successful football club? You know, why has Sydney been so successful in this game? And he said, this is going to sound strange, but love. So here's Mike Resch saying as well, that what makes a successful teacher? Loving, and referring to The Art of Loving by Fromm. I think he talks about the various aspects of involved in, you know, what's involved in loving your students. So let's hear Mike talking about loving your students.
If you do nothing but meditate on who your audience is, who your students are, and you love them, and you think about what it means to love them, everything starts to change. So my whole career, I think, is just a meditation on loving my students, thinking about what they need at this particular moment, thinking about who they are and where they're coming from. And that's where there's, you know, one of my favorite teaching books is not a teaching book at all. It's Eric Fromm's The Art of Loving. And in that book, he names four things which I think are essential to teaching. He says he calls them the pillars of love, and they are that you have to, like basically true love, it happens when you care about somebody, and that one's easy, hopefully, but if you just care for somebody, then it still doesn't, that's not enough, right? Because, you know, you can care for somebody, but then nothing really changes and doesn't really help the person. So you also have to respond to them. You not only have to care for them, you have to care about them, you also have to respond to them. So you respond to their needs, you respond to their requests, you respond to who they are. And that leads to the other piece of this, is you have to know who they are. You can't really respond to them without knowing them. So being a good teacher requires that you get to know your students, and not just, you know, it's not just them as a aggregate. It's not like, let's get to know Generation Y or whatever. It's about getting to know each individual as well. And then the fourth element then is that you have to respect them. And that, I think, is the one that runs counter the most to teaching culture. And you know, you said you don't like the word teaching. I mean, sort of implicit in teaching is the idea of a one-up relationship and authoritarianism. And that mutual respect is really essential, I think. And it doesn't mean that you don't realize at points that you are the expert in the room and that you should lead. It doesn't mean that you're not going to lead at times. It just means that you're also going to recognize the gifts of the people around you. You're going to respect where they're at and where they're going. And that all of those things are really hard to do, and it takes a lot of practice. And that's why my teaching didn't change overnight. It changed through a long meditation on these things and thinking about what it is to love my students and know and learning more about them and learning more about what they need and where they might be going and all of that.
So there you go. Now, obviously, there are going to be contexts where this may not be possible. And I find myself thinking about the vet sector where I work. It's a very heavily regulated system. And lately, the trend is towards kind of getting the job done, getting through the training packages, which are like curricula, and looking after the social or emotional needs of students is starting to be seen as over-servicing, you know, wasting time on stuff which is not so necessary. So I can't see this new world of our system accommodating these notions of love and caring for a student. It doesn't matter. It doesn't mean you shouldn't do it, but I can see there's difficulties here. And as Bob Zwick in the text chat said, is this possible in a MOOC? You know, how can you share your love, let's call it love, with 500,000 students? Doesn't seem possible. However, I don't think we should knock this idea of love being essential to being an effective teacher. We just kind of have it up there as a, maybe it's a goal or something that we should always keep in mind. It has some implications too about how you assess things. I mean, if you're looking at students as having been kind of intrinsic value, listen to Mike talking about assessment or the nature of assignments and cheating.
Students cheating, plagiarizing, things like that. And those are the challenging moments where I still, you know, I try to still dig into my, you know, personal resources of love, whatever they might be, and, you know, still try to get their perspective. Why would they cheat? Why would they plagiarize? Yield punishments where necessary, but I also always take a good look back at my assignment that I assigned. Like, what was it about this assignment that would make a student try to sneak past it at all? Like, why would a student cheat on this? What is it that's not engaging or interesting about this assignment? And I actually have gone all the way toward, like, my latest goal is to create a class where everybody is so interested in learning more, improving themselves, and so on, that assignments are unnecessary. Assignments, like, we wouldn't even have to use the word assignment, right? Because the word assignment itself indicates a sort of authoritarianism that's not self-motivated. And that's the key here, is that I would like to have a class at some point that is almost entirely motivated from inside, and yet is also guided. And that's really tricky, right? Because
so if you find your students are cheating or plagiarizing or trying to take shortcuts through the assessment, maybe there's something wrong with your assessment. And I've thought that for a long time, but interesting to think it through to the other extent or to the other side of the equation, that if you are designing assignments the students are cheating, they clearly don't value the assignment and what it is you've asked them to do. The last thing Mike talked about, well, the last thing that I'm going to mention here in this short podcast was the flipped classroom. So here where we have the flipped classroom being that model where what is normally done outside of the classroom is now done in the classroom and vice versa. So before you might stand up and talk and teach in a classroom. You now put that on video, or you send people off to listen to things or to read things. So they get the content out of class, and when they come to class, they discuss it or use it, is the basic premise of the flipped classroom. Here's Mike talking about his flipped approach.
I always try to push the envelope towards inquiry, but I had several times where I've failed in different ways and I had to step back and rethink it and then move forward again. And slowly over 8 years now of really dedicated pushing, I've pushed to a certain extent. And the way my class looks now is that while there's a lot of content being covered, I've tried to design projects for which all of the content is relevant. And this actually has a research basis. There's actually some recent research done that shows that even when you're trying to cover content, students who are allowed to do projects that implement that content in some way outperform those who are simply asked to memorize the content. So, this is done in which you could have a course in which all the content is covered that's going to be on the exam, so it's all covered in the lecture. And in the other class, they can't cover it all in the lecture because they're also doing projects. And it's still the case that those doing projects are outperforming those doing just that get all the coverage. When you're in a situation of having to cover content, I still think projects are really important. So what I do in my classes is in many ways I flip to the classroom, right? So a lot of the content that's required is shifted onto textbooks and videos that they watch outside of class. In class, we take that content, and this is an anthropology class, which is a study of all humans in all times and all places. We do two things with the content. One is I try to give a funny and inspiring mini lecture over the content, more like a TED Talk, right? So it takes the stuff they're reading, and which is a little bit dry because it's textbook form and that kind of thing, and I try to give them sort of a, oh wow, like that's what that means. Like that's actually, these terms that we learned are actually really interesting and they open up all these possibilities. That's what I think a lecture is all about. It's not about delivering information because it's actually really bad at delivering information, but it's pretty good at delivering inspiration. So I always think of it as inspiration rather than information.
And to finish off, there was discussion of the notion of wonder. Reminded me of Howard Rheingold's references to mindfulness in his recent book on being net smart. Mike is working on a book at the moment called The End of Wonder in the Age of Whatever. So he thinks it's going to be a year or so before that's out. So we can all look forward to that and look forward to any other conversation or presentation that Mike may give in the near future, because he's always wonderful to listen to.